Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is brought to you by MX Publishing, with the largest catalog of new Sherlock Holmes books in the world. New novels, biographies, graphic novels, and short story collections about Sherlock Holmes. Find them at mxpublishing.com.
And by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, episode 214, the 223B casebook.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astronomer.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Bigger Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Well, hello there once again, and welcome to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the world's first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees, where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
I'm Bert Wolder.
And Bert, I'm springing for spring. April is here. The birds are out. The buds are coming out of the ground and out of the trees. It is a wonderful time of the year.
It is a wonderful time of the year. I'm completely sprung, but that's because of the poor chair I'm sitting in.
Well, you need to see your local Swiss watchmaker to repair those minute parts.
Yes.
Timely, as always. I like that.
Tiny Swedish wrenches. Yes, tiny Swiss watchmaker.
Well, if you're interested in minute parts, we should also plug our other show, Trifles, which is a weekly podcast that we do. It's about 15, 20 minutes long, where we talk about some of the minutiae in the Sherlock Holmes stories. We are now on our fifth season there, which means we have four Aprils for you to go through if you would like to see what's going on in our minds during the month of April for Sherlockian discussion. If you get over to SherlockHolmesPodcast.com, you can subscribe there as well as on any of your favorite podcast distribution networks. We should mention that this show is available on all of those as well as at ihose.co/ihose214. That'll take you to the show notes for this episode on IHearOfSherlock.com. Of course, we are on all the social networks as I Hear of Sherlock, and we encourage you to be in touch with us. If you'd like to email us, and we do have a handy application for email later in the show, so stay tuned for that. Our email address is comment@IHearOfSherlock.com. You can apply that to our canonical couplets quiz later in the show, where you will win or have an opportunity to win a prize if you participate. So we would love to hear from you.
Bill Peschel is a former journalist who shares a Pulitzer Prize with the staff of the Patriot News in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Sherlock Holmes parodies and pastiches, as well as parodies and pastiches of Agatha Christie and Dorothy L. Sayers. He's the author of Writers Gone Wild, published by Penguin in 2010. His Peschel Press publishes the 223B Casebook series of Sherlockian parodies and pastiches, as well as annotated editions of Dorothy L. Sayers' Whose Body and Agatha Christie's The Mysterious Affair of Styles, The Secret Adversary, and Murder on the Links. He was born in Warren, Ohio, grew up in Charlotte, North Carolina, and lives with his family and animal menagerie in Hershey, Pennsylvania, where the air really does smell like chocolate. Bill, welcome to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here and to be on the other side of the microphone with you.
Well, it's nice to have you there. So let's begin with the same way we begin with really all of our guests. When did you first meet Sherlock Holmes?
I met him like a lot of the other people who've appeared on your show. I met him as a child. One Christmas, my parents gave me the casebook of Sherlock Holmes, this particular edition from Educator Classics Library. I know people can't see it at home, but it's one of the few books I still have. And I should have known then that I was bound for a life of annotating, because this particular book, it says casebook, but it's really Study in Scarlet and a couple of the short stories and this is another novella, but it has some annotations in it. And I didn't quite realize, it seems like I have a fondness for explaining what things mean. But that's what set me off on it. And after that, you know, I read the stories. I enjoyed them very much. I wasn't really as much of a hardcore fan. I was always a fan of the spin-offs, because I wouldn't go see the Sherlock Holmes movies, but I would go see The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother.
Really?
Yeah. And there's still, I mean, I haven't seen very many of the actual television Sherlock Holmes cases, but of course, since I've started doing the 2-3B series, I've read all the stories. I'm a member of the local White Rose Irregulars. So it's really allowed me to educate myself and be a part of the Sherlockian community.
Yeah, now that's really interesting. I mean, of all the guests that we've had, I don't know that we've ever had anyone with that combination, you know, who had that interest. And then it sounds like you avoided the movies, or you just weren't interested. I mean, was it because what you had in your mind from reading the character was something you didn't want to see portrayed in a different way on the screen, or?
Not really. I guess it's just.
Do you hate movies?
Wide and varied interests. Oh, in fact, I remember now, They Might Be Giants. With George C. Scott, I saw that as a kid. I saw a lot of things, you know, on television as a kid that I look back on and thought, my God, there's movies like The Ballad of Cable Hogue that I remember vividly, The Hallelujah Trail. But They Might Be Giants really was, it impressed me just for the sheer weirdness of it, with George C. Scott as a modern Sherlock Holmes. And I still remember the ending to it. So it's really, I have too many varied interests to really. I admire the people who do, like Denny Daubry, who has his Sherlock Holmes sitting room in his basement and all the wonderful artifacts. I'm a great appreciator of Sherlock Holmes. But as far as, there's just too many interests, too many things to read that I can't focus on one thing unless I actually make it a project, which is one reason why the Peschel Press kind of got started, because it allowed me to focus on things that I really wanted to work on and give me a finished product at the end of it.
Well, let's talk about that in a second. I'm just so curious, because I too am a big fan of They Might Be Giants with George C. Scott, and also The Smarter Brother. But are you a movie fan in addition to being a fan of mysteries? I mean, do you like to go to the movies? Do you have favorite movies?
I have a lot of favorite movies. I'm not really that much of a movie buff, unless I actually. We've been actually seeing more now, my wife and I, Teresa and I, we co-run Peschel Press. And so we've been seeing a lot more movies at home for just the fact that we have DVDs and a lot more time. Working at a newspaper, like I did for 20 plus years, you're working afternoons, you're working evenings, you're totally out of sync with the rest of society. So when I could catch things, I would catch them. And it would be, and stuff would just happen. It would come across, like the coming across the 7% solution back in the day. I still have my first edition on the shelf. And again, I read through that and was just absolutely knocked out that someone like Nicholas Meyers could actually, to me, recreate Sherlock Holmes and succeed at it and add a new dimension to his character. So it really just depends. I like a lot of things. So I'm not a horror fan, but I could appreciate movies like Get Out. I'm a comedy fan. So I'll watch, this is going to be heretical. You may have to cancel me after this. I loved Holmes and Watson. It is, I've seen it twice already. And It is, to me, it is funny.
And that's the Will Ferrell picture.
The Will Ferrell movie, just for the way he structures each of those scenes, and they become more ludicrous and more ludicrous. And he's doing it all with a straight face. And succeeding. And to me, that was just It's a great movie to me. And oh, I understand good. Why some people absolutely despise it, or they despise Will Ferrell in general. So, but you know, what can I say? There's some things I really, really like.
Well, and you don't have to apologize for it. And also time tends to change people's perceptions of these things. I remember after Without a Clue came out, I mean, I saw Without a Clue. I generally think any Sherlock Holmes is good Sherlock Holmes, but, and I saw Without a Clue and I said, you know, I mean, this didn't really do much for me. But now, the last time I saw Without a Clue, I just was blown away by really how clever I thought a lot of it was. So we'll have to see what time does for Will Ferrell.
It is. And yes, he's made some terrible movies as well. I won't defend that. But, you know, the ones I've seen, I've also understood, and this is from my journalism reading, because when in the newspapers starting in 95, the internet came in and I started reading a lot. I was reading a lot of wire copy. I was reading a lot of overseas papers and coming to realize how much sometimes my taste does not match the critical consensus, and that the best way to find out is simply to experience it yourself. It's easy to say, rely on borrowed opinions about anything. And that includes Sherlock Holmes, Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, but you really have to read it yourself and find out where your truth lies in that.
So you mentioned this earlier and I sort of got off track, but how did the Peschel Press come about? Now the Peschel Press is, if my memory's right, it's about 11 years old. So how did that all get started with you?
I've had a long time ambition to have books published, to write books. And I had a hard time actually getting launched. And it was actually until one of the side effects of being in journalism was I collected a lot of material, and I collected a lot of material about writers. And I was always fascinated about the creative process and their lives and the things they got up to when they weren't writing. And I ended up actually writing and marketing a book called Writers Gone Wild, which was published by Penguin. That was my first publication back in 2010. And it was released the same week that Borders went out of business. So immediately, half of the potential sales just vanished, and they weren't interested in a sequel. And I was kind of left at what to do. And about this time, self-publishing started getting into gear. And I had wanted to, back in the 80s, back when I was with a medieval recreation group called the Society for Creative Anachronism, I had actually started thinking about publishing medieval works for just, you know, as a small thing. And of course, to do that, you needed to have typesetting experience and layout experience, and you needed to have money to buy books, and then you have to sell them, and that never went anywhere. And I'm realizing that I could do the same thing. And in fact, in particular, I was working on the Whimsy Annotations, because to be honest, I'm also a Dorothy L. Sayers fan. I was just about to start on Whose Body when I realized, hey, this is out of copyright in the U.S. Instead of just writing the footnotes and publishing them online, I could actually make a book of my own. And that got me started. And of course, I had to call it something. And for complete lack of imagination and a lot of ego, I named it for myself. You know, if it was good enough for Ballantine and Knopf, it should be good enough for Bill Peschel. I went ahead and published it and started doing some of the Agatha Christie's as well. And there's a Victorian murderer, William Palmer. And there were some books out about him, and I brought those back in because those only existed in either first edition, you know, hardcovers or terribly scanned PDFs. So this was a way of bringing back some of those works. And then long about 2014 or so, and I was looking for other projects, I had learned that about R.C. Lehman, who was a punch writer, among other things. He was this Victorian gentleman who loved to do various things. He was also an expert rower and actually wrote some books about sculling, rowing contests. I think he went to Oxford, I believe. Anyway, he wrote a 17-story cycle about Picklock Holmes. And there was a small publication that came out, and, you know, long gone, I thought, wow, maybe I can bring these back. I can actually publish them. It grew from there to the early punch parodies of Sherlock Holmes, which was the first book in the series. And it was not just parodies. I went through, there were PDFs of old punch from the Victorian era. So I'm scanning through and I'm finding references to Conan Doyle, cartoons about Conan Doyle. There's stories about his play, one-act play, Waterloo, received notice. I looked for reviews of the Sherlock Holmes books. And I compiled basically a scrapbook this is one of those things when you do something that you realize in the future that maybe it's the kind of story you only tell when you can laugh about it. I contacted Punch because they had half the book was basically under copyright still. The notable picture by Bernard Partridge of the huge Conan Doyle shackled to the small Sherlock Holmes. I wanted to use those and I contacted them and they said, oh, sure, sure. Just write a check for £3,000. And I said, dear, can I spend £3,000 on copyright? And she looked at me and said, well, if you really want to do it. And we did.
Really? See,
yes, absolutely. And the Punch people are fine. I have nothing against it. They saw me coming and I was at this point where I had not learned about that little thing called profit and loss. And so I got the book I wanted out of it, but I'm never going to make any money off of it whatsoever. It is what it is. There's certain things that I wish I hadn't done, but that's the start. After that, I was like, well, where can I go from here? And this is sort of where slowly the germ of the idea came up to reproduce, gather and find, you know, reprint all the major Sherlockian parodies, whatever I could find for the various eras up until Conan Doyle's death in 1930. And that's the start of the series. And then 5 years later, 6 years later, we end up with, 8 volumes, a best of, and one more book coming out about James Thurber.
About Thurber. So this is Thurber's connections with Sherlock Holmes?
Yes. When he was a reporter for the Columbus Evening Dispatch, he had a half a page on which he could write anything he wanted. And it was supposed to be, you know, comedy. It's light stuff on the Sunday page. And part of that process, he wrote 13 stories, short stories, they're only like 1,000 words each, 1,500 words, about a character called Blue Plerimel, which was his Sherlock Holmes knockoff. Because they're now in the public domain, I decided we'll do one more book for the series, and I'm in the process of editing it, so it should come out hopefully within a month or two. And it's juvenilia. I want to stress that. It's him at 25 finding his writer voice, his humorous voice, and doing it through these stories about this super scientific detective and his Chinese manservant and his run-ins with the police and trying to tell a comic story, trying to make a comic cycle out of it. And it's fascinating to watch him develop his talent, and certain elements of it you can see in his later work as well.
Well, that's fascinating. I'm a big Thurber fan, but I had no idea that he had written. And what is the name of his detective?
The character is Blue, like the color, and Plerimel, Plerimell. And the best I can think of, because it's not confirmed, is that it's a close... Thurber was very much into writing parodies, because he parodied especially Henry James, and he parodied, actually did a Sherlockian-like casebook of James Thurber. But it's the closest thing to Scarlet Pimpernel.
Oh, of course. The Baroness Orzy. Sure, yeah. Scarlet Pimpernel, Blue Paramel. What is a paramel? Is that also a flower?
I looked it up, and the closest I can thumb, it's a name of a commune in France. And before he started work at the newspaper, he was actually a code clerk in Paris, and he went roaming about the countryside. He visited Normandy, visited Brittany, and all I could assume is that he came across that name and decided, because one of the things that distinguishes Thurber is his love for words. He loves playing with words. He loves making up words. There's even there's one of his books, and I cannot remember it now, but it's a very odd title. And the word is actually from the code book that he used as a code clerk for the State Department in Paris. I can't remember if it's the Magnificent something or the Great something. It was like Baloo. It's a very nonsense word, but that's where he got it from.
That's fabulous. Fascinating. The first Sherlock Holmes parody was probably written in 1896, The Field Bazaar, by Arthur Conan Doyle himself. He knew laughing was good for you. That's why the Wessex Press continues the tradition with The True Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Terence Faherty. It's a rare collection of Watson's early first drafts of the cases of Sherlock Holmes that will show you the truth behind the engineer's thumb and the strange insanity of General Waxbutton. Learn the actual facts behind the adventure of the notorious parasol chaser, and astonish your friends when you tell them the man with the twisted lip actually struck it big as a part-time bustle fitter. 7 of these great stories have been published in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, and 4 appear here for the very first time in this very first collection. Now is the perfect time for a comfortable chair and a long laugh. Get the true adventures of Sherlock Holmes at WesExpress.com today. Well, I'll really look forward to that book. Thurber is a great, I'm a big fan of Thurber and his writing. And you must, of course, know the Macbeth murder mystery, which I think is one of his funniest stories, where it's set in a place where, I don't know, there's some storm is with a group of people in a hotel and there's nothing to read. A mystery fan is forced to consult a Shakespeare play and begins to treat it and analyze it like a detective story. So if our listeners have not read Thurber's Macbeth murder mystery, you know, I think we can recommend that. But that's great. How interesting.
Oh, yeah. And it also got me into the movies as well, because of as a way of filling out the book, because it's basically like 15,000 words. So one thing I like doing is adding content to it. So there's, you know, an essay about Thurber and his literary development growing up in Columbus and his influences. There's reviews of the various movies that have been made. Like there's been two of Walter Mitty. There's been two of The Male Animal, including one called She's Working Her Way Through College with Virginia Mayo and Ronald Reagan. And there's even a movie about that used Thurber as a character portrayed by Jack Lemmon in the early 60s called The War Between Men and Women. That was just startling as a form of kind of misogyny taken, you know, with Thurber's attitude towards women, towards especially strong women. This just took it up and dialed it to 11. And Jason Robards is in that as well. And it's an interesting period piece, very reflective of the culture and their attempt to do Thurber. And in fact, the end of the movie is the 11 minutes is basically semi-animated version of The Last Flower. That's right. Isn't that right? That's his anti-war screed.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So like I said, it's a very peculiar, this is why I like doing this sort of thing, because it just gets me into areas I never would have gone there on my own. And of course, I've been reading Thurber as well. So and trying to figure out just how, because he's always been said as he's the modern Mark Twain. I don't know. There's going to be some things, you know, some various strong things. Walter Mitty will last. There's no doubt about that. It's entered the language now. In fact, it's a very strong, it's a slang phrase in England, particularly among officers, among the officer corps. Some of the other stuff, but he's definitely worth reading. I'll grant him that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And years ago, you know, I don't know if you remember this or saw this or dealt with it in any way, but there was a very brief television series. It didn't last very long, with William Wyndham as Thurber, or a Thurber-like character, called My World and Welcome to It, which I remember enjoying, but I don't even know if that still exists anywhere.
It's possible. It only lasted one season. And as a matter of fact, that is another one of my childhood influences, because I saw the show because the girl on there, Lisa Gerritsen, she shows up in The War Between Men and Women as well. So she's actually played in two Thurber products. Well, the producer of My World and Welcome to It also did, I think, The War Between Men and Women, which is why it has such a strong Thurber content to it.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's a very interesting one. And William Wyndham became one of my favorite actors as well. I'd see his name, I guess maybe because of the W's. He also appeared in a movie called The House on Green Apple Road, which was an ABC movie of the week. It left an impression on me because the show starts off with the police entering this empty house that is absolutely smeared in blood. And you're only like 12 or 13 years old watching this and going, wow, what the heck is going on here? And then, of course, they tell the story of what happened there. And of course, he starred in the movie. So again, the memory throws up some really weird connections, and I like using it to inform my work with the Peschel Press.
During all those years, I mean, what over the last 11 years, is there any one project that seems to you to have been the most rewarding or the most fun or the most surprising?
Well, they all have to be fun to me in some way for me to do this, because you just can't sit down and put out 8 books of Sherlockian parodies without finding something along the way. For me, a lot of it was tracing the biographies of some of the writers. Because I write an introduction to each of the stories and somehow try to say, leave something new or something interesting about that person or about the parody, even just describing what it is. There's in the Great War II volume, I found the silent film, The Mystery of the Leaping Fish, It was a silent movie. And you have to think about this intersection, this Venn diagram. It's a Sherlockian parody, a short starring Douglas Fairbanks, written by Anita Loose of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and directed by Todd Browning, who did Freaks. And it is, the clip is available on YouTube, and I included scenes from, again, because I'm the publisher, I can do what I want. If I go to myself and say, I want to include scenes from this movie with the subtitles as part of a print Sherlockian collection, I can say, yes, go ahead, do it. And it is heavy into drugs. This is Sherlock who is just taking all kinds of drugs and running around in this outlandish outfit. And he goes into Chinatown. So you have all the Chinatown stereotypes there. And it's just a really bizarre 15 to 20 minutes of motion picture history. And it's nice to be able to bring that back. And it's also nice just bringing all these other items as well, because I get to publish The Unique Hamlet by Vincent Starrett, and finding the Sherlockian parodies that P.G. Wodehouse did, and being able to publish those, and finding some of these very other ones like Carolyn Wells and republishing it with the original art, or at the last one in the last book, the first Solar Ponds adventure. So you could see how through the books, the image of Sherlock Holmes changes, how people use Sherlock Holmes, because the communists used him as a capitalist tool. Dashiell Hammett wrote a short Sherlockian parody as well. And one of the highlights for me was in the first Jazz Age volume, which was the Teapot Dome case, which has not been seen at all by anybody. I happened to come across it. It's in the Brooklyn Daily Eagle, and it was a parody of the Teapot Dome scandal. And it appeared on the front page, three paragraphs at a time for like 90 days. And it had song parodies. It had references to other crimes like the bobbed hair bandit, which I had to research to find out who she was. Of course, it had specific mentions of the Teapot Dome scandal and how the Bureau of Investigation got involved, and how the publisher of the Washington Post got involved in it. All these stories that I'm pulling up out of this one really bizarre parody. It had a lot of oil puns as well. You know, the oligarchy or the Oiligany River. Putting this back together was like an archaeologist putting together this creature that nobody has ever seen before since its original publication in the 1920s, and say, wow, look at this, and look what it meant to the people at the time who were reading this in the Brooklyn Daily Eagle. It was just an amazing bit of archaeological reconstruction.
Now, of course, our listeners can find out more about publications from the Peschel Press and about the 223B series on your website, which is peschelpress.com. It's PESCHELPRESS.com. You know, just for the sake of this discussion, could you just describe a little bit of how the layout is of the volumes in the 223B series, how many books there are and what they cover?
Okay, there are, let's see, let me count them out, because I call it, as I was putting this out, I had trouble structuring this as well. So numbering is kind of problematic, but I can certainly say there's a Punch volume, there's a Victorian volume, and that covers 10 years from roughly 1888 to 1899. And then afterwards, they were broken up in 5-year chunks. So there's two Edwardian books. There's two what I call Great War books, but the first Great War is like 1910 to 1914. And the second one is from 1915 to 1919. And then after that, there's the Jazz Age from, 1920 to 25, and then 25 to 1930. So they're chronological order. And I tried to keep to the chronology as well, but some of the ones, they were just published in books and I didn't know when they were. So that's kind of loose, but you're definitely within certain years. And then I published a best of, which is, of course, just the ones that I think were good. And I wanted to make sure, because Otto Penzler put out the big book of Sherlock Holmes parodies, I actually wanted to make sure that none of my picks duplicated what he found. Because there's so much material. You know, he got good stuff. I got the good stuff. You can buy both books and then not worry that you wasted some money, because there's duplications in there. And then, of course, I'm coming up with Blue Plaramel as well. And that's another specialty subject by itself.
Now, what happens when, now that the series, you've come to the conclusion of the series, what happens when you find something, that you say to yourself, uh-oh, this should have been in the 1918 volume? Have you, or does that not happen anymore?
It still does. And there's material, for example, John Kendrick Bangs wrote a Sherlock Holmes series for the newspapers around 1903, and that was 10 stories. And, you know, again, most of them have not been seen. So I end up, I try to republish them on the website. And for a while, I was doing it every Wednesday, and I republished some of the stories from the books as well. Just why not? Because they're there. So anything in the future will show up on the website. And I had thought, I had toyed with another one, like having another volume. But I think part of the thing as well is just I really have moved on to other things. And of course, I'm running a business full time. So I still like keeping the Sherlock Holmes series, and I love keeping it alive. But I think once we get to Blue Plaramel, that's going to be it as far as print publications. Although I did publish a series of short stories of pastiches myself involving Sherlock Holmes and Mark Twain. And that's the casebook of Twain and Holmes, because why not rename your book from the best? And that's 7 stories. And I do want to do more in that realm. So I'll go from reprinting other people's pastiches to actually making my own.
In all of your reading and collect, well, first of all, did you ever count them all up? How many Sherlockian parodies do you think are in the series? I mean, is it 100, 1,000, 10,000?
In the whole series, I've never counted them, but there's easily 20 per volume. So I've certainly at least got up to 200. But there's the database that I used online. There's an actual database. I think Philip K. Jones, he has his database of Sherlock Holmes pastiches, and he has 10,000 of them listed, you know, for the entire run.
Yeah. Now that gets to a question I really wanted to ask you, which is in your mind, since you really are an authority in this space, what do you think what's the difference between a pastiche and a parody?
Well, it's a question of intent. A pastiche, you're trying to replicate the experience. So you're playing you can play the game and you're taking Sherlock seriously. A parody, you can take Sherlock seriously, but you're actually doing something else. I wouldn't necessarily know if this is a parody or not, but I'm thinking of one in which it was written by a doctor who was rather upset with the way Watson was treated. And so he wrote one in which Watson is the hero. He's actually working at a clinic and Sherlock is walking with him through the clinic. And Watson is acting like a real doctor. He's diagnosing symptoms, sort of like what Joseph K. Bell did. And Sherlock is the fool. The cases are all straightforward and they're played straight. So is that a pastiche? But it's also making fun of Sherlock and showing how out of his depth he is with regards to medical things. So that makes it a parody as well.
So do you think that a good parody is always based on affection? You think affection is maybe a characteristic of a parody where it might not be for a pastiche?
Actually, it's not. I think of the ones in which they're using Sherlock for political purposes, such as the one that Dashiell Hammett wrote is really more... It's contrasting Sherlock as the amateur detective against his Pinkerton experiences and dealing with people in power. So it's not necessarily affectionately expressed towards Sherlock. It's really more of making a more telling point about this is what real life is like. This is not what you're going to find with Sherlock. And then the one in the Daily Worker is simply out and it's communist propaganda. It is. So it's certainly not, it's using Sherlock because he's a known figure. And that's sort of the weird thing about how, and this is what I always like about legacies. Sherlock entered the public consciousness thanks to the success of the Conan Doyle stories. And it's almost like a chicken and egg thing, because in order for a parody to succeed, people have to know the original source material. And by making a parody of it, you're also perpetuating the original source material as well. And this is why we have tons of Sherlock parodies. And I always puzzle over this feature as well. You don't get much in the way of, say, Tarzan parodies or Poirot parodies. You have some, but they didn't enter the common language like Sherlock Holmes did. And that's, I'm absolutely fascinated by that, as I am by the character of Conan Doyle himself. Part of the fun of the books was I wrote a yearly essay, you know, for the year 1914. What was he doing? And thank goodness I have like Brian Pugh's chronology of the life of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, because he goes day by day by day. And I look at his schedule and astonished at the amount of living and amount of effort he put literally into it, like every day of his life. Absolutely fascinating man.
Well, I think we got to the point here where we need you to check out a word from our sponsor. We will bring you a word from MX Publishing. They have a program now called Books to Books. You heard of their Books to Trees program, where they would plant a tree for every book that's purchased. Well, now, with Books to Books, they are actually funding not only the 1,000 trees, but they're turning it into donations to the Happy Life Schools in Kenya, where they are helping kids to read. With the expansion of Happy Life Schools, MX tells us that the team are providing education not just for the 150 kids at Happy Life, but hundreds more in the local communities. And the Books to Books project, they want to fund 1,000 school books by the end of 2021. So every $50 that you spend on the MX Publishing website will go towards a $5 donation, the average cost of a school book, to Happy Life. So when you get to enjoy the fine books from MX Publishing, and believe me, there are quite a few to choose from, the kids at the Happy Life Village in Kenya will also benefit from what it is that you're enjoying. So thank you to MX Publishing for expanding reading beyond our borders and beyond the usual and helping kids to become literate. And now, back to our show.
Well, too, I think in connection with parodies, Conan Doyle may be unique, maybe he isn't. Two of the parodies of Sherlock that always stand out to me are The Adventure of the Two Collaborators. Now, that was written by J.M. Barrie, yeah, because Conan Doyle and Barrie had worked on an unsuccessful play together. And it was commiserating about that failure that Barrie wrote that parody. But also what Doyle himself wrote, How Watson Learned the Trick, which mm-hmm. really does parody his style and these little bits of Sherlockismus. And so he was not above parodying himself.
Yes, he is. He was self-aware to a certain degree. And at the same time, even though he may have resented Sherlock, he also relied on him for supporting himself in the life to which he wanted to become accustomed as well. So there's that tension there as well that makes him actually a more fascinating figure, because we can enjoy all the stories. Some do a better, more degree than others. And yes, I have the Two Collaborators essay in the Victorian volume, along with My Evening with Sherlock Holmes, which Charlie Press figured out was written by him, and the late Sherlock Holmes. So there's three in the Victorian volume.
Well, yes, and there's a lovely line I remember from The Two Collaborators where Holmes says to Doyle, "You fool, thanks to me you have ridden extensively in cabs, a place where authors are never found. Without me, you will ride only in buses."
Absolutely. That's why I love lines like that. That's speaking, that's kind of like speaking a little bit of truth in the middle of the story there.
Yeah, I think that's great. Well, let's talk for a minute about annotations. Now you've done these annotations of the Whimsy stories. How does the task of annotating Peter Whimsy contrast to the task of Holmes? Because I would not have thought that there's that much to annotate in a Whimsy story, since it was written, in the 1920s, let's say, as opposed to the 1890s.
Yeah. Well, Dorothy Sayers was Oxford educated. And Whimsy, of course, is Oxford educated as well. So I initially started it with her book, Gaudy Night, which was her Oxford novel. Harriet Vane goes back to Oxford, and there's, plenty of philosophical discussions and plenty of stuff in foreign languages, including Greek. And I was at work at the newspaper, and I had downtime because I worked on the copy desk. And the internet had really come into being starting in the mid-90s. So I ended up, for my own entertainment, starting to look up the various references. Dorothy Sayers is also an interesting writer in that she wrote about her times. Her stories contain a lot of details, many of them spin-offs of her life. She wrote a short story about two motorcyclists and the Adventure of the Cat in the Bag, I think, based on her experiences, because one of her relationships was with a motorcycle mechanic, and she rode a motorcycle. She learned how. So she infused the story with the details of that, because they're arguing about brands of motorcycles, which ones were superior. You think of the Apple and IBM wars, between geeks back in the 90s. It was that same type of my brand is better than yours. And you have to look up the AA organization, which was the precursor to the Automobile Association. What were they doing? It was a grassroots group that helped with the rules of the road. They would stand on the road with a flag and direct traffic. So she wrote about a lot of things that really needed explanation because they were of their time. They were contemporary stories. But nowadays we look at that and we have no idea, especially if you're American. I mean, you have no idea what British life is like. What is a dowager duchess? What is a peer? And how does that differ from a lordship or a baron or anything else? And again, there was so much stuff in her books. And I was educating myself as well, because she would be discussing philosophies, Heteroclitus, I think. And, you know, you can't cross a stream the same time. You know, you can't cross a stream twice in the same place. And like I said, I'm just fascinated by all these side roads to go down and pursue.
Well, and a lot there. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. Gaudi Knight is a great example. Well, coming to the end here, I just have to ask you. So you've had an unusual career diving deeply into parody, into pastiche, into some of the great writers, into the facts that their authors insert into the stories, putting it into modern terms. After all of that, Bill Peschel, who's your favorite detective? Is it Lord Peter Wimsey? Is it Hercule Poirot? Is it Tommy and Tuppence? Is it Holmes? Do you have a favorite detective? Do you have a favorite author?
Boy, that is a tough, tough question.
You're going to a desert island and you can only take one book. What is
it? It's got to be Holmes. For that, the sheer breadth of the stories, the sheer breadth of the storytelling, the lovely byplay between Holmes and Watson, some of the amazing trenchant observations that Holmes make, I'd say hands down, it would have to be Sherlock.
Wow.
putting it that way, it makes it a lot easier to say, okay, there.
Well, putting it that way, one of the things that will make your life easier, listeners, if you're interested in parodies and pastiches, the place to go is to the Peschel Press, and particularly the 223B series. Thanks, Bill Peschel. Thanks for being with us on I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere.
Thank you so much, Bert. It was a pleasure.
Well, I have to commend you on the selection of our guest this time around, Bert, because we don't often focus on Sherlockian parody. I think pastiches get all of the attention. They tend to be the most popular, you know, with the advent of someone like Nicholas Meyer and 7% Solution, or Lindsay Fay with Dust and Shadow. You know, we see these very popular pastiches, but for some reason, parodies just, I don't get no respect at all, I'll tell you.
For me, it was an untapped vein. You know, I never paid much attention to it, but I recently became aware of the enormous contribution parody plays in keeping the character of Sherlock Holmes alive and also pointing readers to the stories. And unlike other great detectives, I mean, think of all of the famous detectives we mentioned when I was talking to Bill Peschel about Dashiell Hammett, but just think about Dashiell Hammett, about Mickey Spillane, about Hercule Poirot and Lord Peter Wimsey. There have been parodies of them, certainly, but nothing like the vast amount. You know, in talking to Bill, he's brought together over 40 years of parodies, certainly in the hundreds. And it's amazing. And the lovely thing about it, as I talked to Bill, was, first of all, that Conan Doyle was not above self-parody, and he did a couple of those, including that one with James Barry that Bill and I talked about, but also the affection that's inherent in the parody. And you see that in the ones written by P.G. Wodehouse, how much people adored Holmes, and the opportunity to play with those techniques was very attractive to people.
Yeah, it's clear they had fun with it, and I would expect that they would hope that their readers would have fun with them as well. You know, what's interesting to me, amid all of this incredible volume of parody, particularly during Conan Doyle's lifetime, when we move through history, coming up to, say, the 1970s, when Sherlock Holmes made this huge resurgence in popularity, thanks in no small part to Nicholas Meyer. We get to something like Murder by Death by Neil Simon, which is a wonderful, wonderful parody of a number of detectives. Charlie Chan and Miss Marple and Hercule Poirot, Sam Spade. And yet, in the final cut, Sherlock Holmes does not make an appearance. There is a deleted scene that typically makes its occasional foray to the public in, I think, the television version of the movie, where Holmes and Watson do make an appearance. And the reason that they were cut out of the final version, this is interesting, all of the other actors who were playing these other parodies of these other detectives felt as if they were upstaged, because Holmes and Watson came in, solved the case in like 9 seconds and left. And here they were slaving over this locked room mystery at the haunted mansion, so to speak, over the course of an entire evening. And so Holmes doesn't make an appearance in what is probably one of the most famous detective parody movies of all time.
It's a very good example, and that's an interesting picture. You know, I loved David Niven and Maggie Smith, who were Dick and Dora Charles in that one. And it is, a bit slapstick. And, of course, Nancy Walker was in that. But that picture has something else that we should be grateful for, because my memory of this, and I'm always the first one to say my memory of this could be wrong, but my memory of this is the reason why Alec Guinness was able to go to work on Star Wars was that he'd been in California to do his scenes for Murder by Death. And that's how he came to, I think that's how he came to be easily cast by George Lucas in Star Wars.
Oh, that's very fortunate. We are all the beneficiaries of Benson Mum as a result.
Yes.
Ah, those dulcet tones mean it's time for everyone's favorite Sherlockian quiz program. That's right, it's Canonical Couplets, where we give you two lines of poetry and you give us an answer in the form of a Sherlockian story. Now, if you remember the last time we were with you, we gave you this clue. Another case we'll never know, this time in Rotherhithe. Thanks to Mrs. Hudson, Watson helps Holmes come back to life. Bert, do you know which story we're talking about?
Yes, I do. That's a great case where Holmes' client is a maiden lady who receives some very old smoked salmon in the post. That's the Adventure of the Cardboard Lox.
While that sounds eminently tasty, Bert, I'm going to have to say no, that is not the correct answer. Nor is it what Eric Decker's posited. He said it's one of his favorite Sherlock Holmes stories, the one where he followed the Grateful Dead around for several months, selling colorful T-shirts to other deadheads. That's The Adventure of the Tie-Dying Detective. Oh, Eric. Thank you for that, as always. And thank you for relieving us of Bert's parody, Bert's humor. In this case, no, we have The Adventure of the Dying Detective. So close. Both of you were so close. One of you a little closer than the other. Well, let's see, of all of the correct entries that were sent in, let's see who actually gets the prize. So we will bring out our big prize wheel here. We'll wheel it into the studio and we'll give it a big spin. And it's slowing down, coming to rest on number 38. Number 38. That's a good number. And in this case, it corresponds to Mary Miller. Mary, good to have you back with us and good to see you in the winner's column once again. So you are the lucky recipient of a special prize from our vault. You'll never know what it is, folks. So wait and see on that one. Now, in the meantime, we have another canonical couplet ready, and in the queue for you, and here it is. Stranded and friendless in a hostile town, it took a local drag hound to run the Braum to ground. If you know the answer to this week's canonical couplet, drop it in an email to comment@ihearofsherlock.com with canonical couplet in the subject line. If you are correct and we choose you at random, you will win. Good luck. And I should mention that this episode's winner will receive a copy of the 223B casebook by Bill Peschel. So stay tuned for that very on-brand prize. Well, speaking of on-brand, Bert, what else do you have going on?
What else do I have going on? Just the usual. I've got a group of Norwegian jugglers that are coming by for lunch, and, you know, we're busy trying to defrost the Ludovisk. but that's something that typically happens here, you know, around this day of the week. So that's certainly nothing special.
Very good.
And then there's the excavations that are always moving ahead in the back garden as we've dug up those rose bushes and are putting in our underground bunker.
Always helpful.
I got to tell you, the problem there is the pool table. You know, you're not going to want to spend a lot of time down below ground, particularly in times of emergency or strife, without, you know, reasonable sport or game. And so you'd think that people would make pool tables that are relatively easy to put 20, 30 feet below ground. But no, you know, you really have to shop around. And the problem is balancing the table, among other things. And, you know, people will cast a concrete platform and put it 30, 40 feet below your lawn. And they will tell you, you know, it's completely level. But when you get down there with an eight ball and start sliding it around the table, the last thing you want to see is everything drifting to the left.
Well, the good news is if you're underground in a bunker trapped with a pool table that is not level, it'll give you plenty to do in the time that the radiation clears out to figure out exactly how to level it. So just make sure you bring plenty of paper napkins to fold and put under that one leg.
I've got matchbooks. You know, I've got a collection of matchbooks.
That works,
yeah,
too.
Those are always good, yeah.
Well, good. Well, if folks haven't been catching things on television lately, on Netflix in particular, the new show The Irregulars came to our attention, a limited episode series, and it is kind of a fanciful update on the Baker Street Irregulars, the homeless children who help Holmes out. The show focuses on them. Holmes and Watson do make a couple of cameo appearances, but it seems to be catching on, kind of a combination of the supernatural and the Victorian, updated with some common modern sensibilities. And I've been hearing some good things about it from people online. Haven't seen it yet myself, but it is on the list of things to get to. Have you seen it?
No, I have not. I'm waiting for the animated version first.
I'm sure there will be an animated version out there before too long. Well, before this show gets too long, I am the completely unanimated and unanimatronic Scott Monty.
And I'm the poorly drawn Bert Wolder.
And you'll be drawn and quartered before too long. Well, until the next time, the two of us have the pleasure of saying the game's afoot.
Foot.
The game's afoot.
I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I am neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.